Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Morin Rout. Marianne, our first guest is going to be Belle from Scorpio, who's come into the studio with a huge pile of books, as she usually does, to talk about what people are reading.
Indeed. And then I've got two books, which I don't think I've ever chatted about with Belle, but are definitely available at Scorpio's as well. The first is Peter Ryan, Riding the Echo Down. It's a book for people who are looking to be inspired by adventure in the wild. It's not just for hunters. It is a rich history of adventures across Aotearoa and South America and South Africa. And then I'm speaking with Vanessa Croft, who just happens to be Peter Ryan's wife, and about her first novel, which is a historical novel called Where in All the World. And it, interestingly enough, is a retelling of the story of one of the adventurers in Peter's book. So there we go. So Peter Ryan, Vanessa Croft, and Belle from Scorpio in this week's episode. It's time for our monthly catch-up with Belle from Scorpio Books, who tells us who's reading, or what people are reading, who's reading what, but also what's magical and what we should be reading. So welcome, yes, Belle. Indeed. Lovely to have you back.
Kia ora, Marianne. Thank you very much. So this month's top non-fiction got off to a bit of a sober start, I'm afraid, with the beloved psychologist and broadcaster Nigel Latta passing away on the very day his book Lessons on Living was released.
That was quite remarkable timing,
it was,
wasn't
remarkable,
it?
Remarkable, yeah.
And yeah, truly a truly loved individual for Aotearoa. He spoke once at a work conference of mine,
right.
And what made such a huge impression. But just before his cancer journey. So, yeah, beautiful, beautiful take-outs from that.
Yeah, so this, his final book, which he put together after 3 decades working as a clinical psychologist, he describes the mental toolbox he reckoned that everyone needs to deal with whatever life throws at you, whatever conundrum, big or small. He believed that there were just 3 principles required for life's ups and downs, which is comforting, isn't it? 3 seems like a manageable number. So whatever you want to do, whether it's you want to be a better parent or build an empire or whatever, there's only 3 principles you need to remember. So he shows you how to respond to any situation with resilience, joy, and attention to what matters most. So it's a cracker. What a gift to leave behind, and people are clearly grateful for it because it's
flying off the shelves. Great.
Yeah.
Great.
So our next top 2 non-fiction titles are both autobiographies. Both have huge nostalgia value for me and for many others. So both these books had a big impact on the world. Well, not these books, but these writers had a big impact on the world in the 90s. Did you ever read Wild Swans?
Yes, I did.
Yes. And the Booker-winning novel, The God of Small Things.
Yes, I did.
Well, this is going to be nostalgic for you too. So we'll start with Wild Swans. So that was a hugely popular family history by Chinese writer Yang Cheng. And this month sees the release of its sequel, Fly Wild Swans.
Yes. I've been hearing about this, so tell us what your take on it
is. Yeah, so I'm sure you will remember this too, but many people my age remember the graphic descriptions of Cheng's grandmother's foot binding and what her life was like under China's last emperor, and then the book went on to her mother's story and then her own story. So we moved through Mao's rule and the Cultural Revolution, and that book finished in 78 when Deng Xiaoping officially ended the Mao era. And at that pivotal moment. That's when Cheung became one of the first Chinese to leave China, communist China, and move to the West. So Fly Wild Swans, this new one, picks up where that book left off and brings her story, her family's story, and China's story up to the present day.
Fabulous.
So it's nearly half a century on, and China has risen from a... not downtrodden, what should we
more
say?
More an agricultural...
agrarian, isolated state to a global power. And despite living in the West, Young's life was still entwined with everything going on in China, especially since all of her books are still banned. And so now we're at another watershed moment at the end of, with the era of Chairman Xi Jinping's greatly affecting the lives of Young and her mother. So this is her heartfelt response to that experience, and it's a book filled with drama and love and curiosity and the incredible history that we had in the first one. It's both personal and global. It's ultimately uplifting.
Told. Is it going to be as much of a classic as Wild Swans has become, do you believe?
Oh, that's a big call. I think because that book was... it really brought a lot of that history to the West to be consumed sort of by the general population.
Yeah, we didn't really know those stories before.
No, that's right.
And women's stories, which I think...
And women's stories, exactly. Mm. But I think maybe there's even more of an appetite for it now, given the current political climate. So
perhaps
it has certainly been incredibly popular since its release last week or...
Great. Okay, so Yung Chang and now Arundhati Joy.
Roy. Yes.
Joy, but
exactly.
Joy, bringing us all joy. Okay.
And those books sort of dovetail together really nicely because Fly Wild Swans is ultimately a love letter to her mother, and this is very much the same. So it's Arundhati Roy's new memoir is called Mother Mary Comes to Me. She, as I said, she's the author of the Booker Prize-winning novel The God of Small Things, which she won when she was very young. And again, it was a book that really brought everyday Indian life. Well, not that it's a very quirky, magical, realist book, but who brought it to a Western audience for sort of mass consumption, which was really huge. So this is her first memoir chronicling childhood to present, from Kerala to Delhi. And I've just finished it last night, so I'm still sort of brimming with it and swimming in it. But it's very intimate and inspiring, and it sort of describes how she became the person she is today and the writer she is today. And I'm sure I'm not alone in only knowing a very small amount about her. I knew she was politically active, but I really hadn't appreciated how politically active she was in India and how much nonfiction writing and how many causes she championed off the back of her Booker fame. So she used that to highlight a lot of issues in India, social and climate, very early climate advocate. Anyway, so it's about all her extraordinary life experiences, but most of all it's about how her very unique and fierce mother shaped who she is today.
So Mother Mary Comes to Me. And is this her mother on the cover, or is that Arundhati Roy?
Front and back, it's her.
Young and now. Beautiful.
So, and it really does have the scale and the sweep and the depth of her novels, and it's full of her passion and political clarity and warmth and... oh, it's just wonderful. I highly, highly recommend it.
Wow. So two women who have shaped our knowledge of their nations in the West,
exactly,
and are contributing to women, justice for women and the planet. Fabulous. As well as Nigel. So three brilliant nonfiction leading your charge this week, this month.
That's excellent. Right. And fiction is equally brilliant. We're at that time of year where it's just, oh my God, it's so exciting.
Okay.
So I'll start with our book of the month, which people are loving and which we talked about this before, but I'll start again. It's Endling by the Ukrainian-Canadian writer Maria Reva. It's on the Booker long list, but I was devastated when it wasn't on the short list.
Have you written to somebody about this?
I should. I should write a stern letter.
You should write that stern letter.
I mean, it was my pick to win this year, and it was many people's picks. So I'm taking this very personally, Mary.
Okay, this is big.
Yeah.
This is big. Long list is pretty good, though, Maria Reva.
Particularly for a debut.
A debut, exactly.
Yeah. So it's a fabulous story. It's about the madcap journey of three women and one extremely endangered snail through contemporary Ukraine. So one of these women is a maverick scientist who scours the country's forests and valleys, trying and sort of failing to breed rare snails. And all the
that sounds like quite a,
it's a noble
quite
course.
A noble,
it's a noble
course.
It is. And all the while her relatives are sort of urging her to settle down and start a family of her own. But what they don't know is that she already dates plenty of men, but not for love. It's to fund her work.
Oh my goodness!
Yes.
Oh, brave girl. So she's quite the hero then.
She is. She's a fascinating character. So she's entertaining foreigners who come to Ukraine on guided romance tours, believing they'll find, docile brides untainted by feminism.
Guided romance tours in the Ukraine
yes,
are a thing.
They're a thing. They're very much a thing.
Lord.
And the two other women on this journey are also embroiled in this booming marriage industry, posing as a hopeful bride and her translator, while secretly they're searching for their missing mother who vanished years ago after her fierce activism work against the romance tours.
So we've got a précis. Now tell us what's brilliant about it.
Oh, well, what is really extraordinary about this novel, and I can't decide whether I want to say it, actually, because I don't want to ruin any surprises, but I'll just say that there's some very playful, meta, inventive twists of form that the writer
uses.
Oh,
my God, meta, playful, inventive twists of form, Belle. Is it beyond
no,
most of us?
No, it's not at all. No, okay. It's not at all. It's not too clever by
it's not
any
too
stretch.
Clever.
No,
because I must say I'm struggling with just how clever Katabasis or however you say it is. So which was your last week's pick? Okay, so Endling, it's going to be this week. This month's Scorpio
Book of the Month. So in November we'll discuss it on the first Tuesday of the month at our book club. Everyone is welcome. You don't have to be a member. You can just buy a ticket.
And you don't have to know what meta twists of form mean.
No, you don't. You don't.
But you might find out.
Yep. I mean, to read such an engaging, thrilling, hilarious, mad book about modern-day Ukraine, I think, is an extraordinary feat and an amazing way to tackle the issues. Yes. So
cool.
We'll move on to another novel flying out the door, which is by English novelist Ian McEwan, who has written a bazillion novels, and some of them have been brilliant and some of them have been very odd. But this is a return to his brilliance. This is what the reviewers are promising us anyway.
Cool.
It's set in a future world that remembers a great poem being read aloud back in the dark days of 2014, and it was never heard again, and it was lost. So we're now in the year 2119, and the lowlands of the UK have been submerged by rising seas. And we have the main character, who's a scholar, poring over the archives of the early 21st century, and he's captivated by human life at its zenith. So he accidentally stumbles across a clue which may lead to the whereabouts of this great lost poem, and there's revelations of entangled love and a brutal crime, and it sort of destroys his assumptions about what he thought he knew. So it sounds incredibly intriguing. It's sort of cli-fi, climate change, futurist, dystopian sort of work, but it's also deeply rooted in the power of story and language and all those delicious things we love. So this is next on my list, this one, because one of his tiny novels on Chesil Beach is an absolute favourite of mine.
Probably so. Best known for Atonement, isn't he? By yes. most readers yes. will know Atonement.
That's right.
But, yeah, a long list of novels. Oh,
long
my God.
List. That's right.
And so What We Can Know by Ian McEwan sounds intriguing.
It is intriguing.
Do we know, is there a real poem at the heart of it, a poem that we know?
Oh, no, I don't think so.
No,
I think it's an invented poem. I might be wrong about that, but Dave has read it, the owner of Scorpio, and he was quite enchanted by it.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Okay, so from Dave himself, Dave from Scorpio Books tells us, read What We Can Know.
That's right. All right, the next important international novel received this month, which has a very good chance at the Booker, I would say. Not that my opinion clearly counts for anything, Booker judges. Thank you very much. It's called Sonia and Sunny, and it's by previous Booker winner Kiran Desai, who wrote The Inheritance of Loss.
So another Indian author.
Yes. Epic in its scope, but it's the story of two young people whose fates intersect and diverge across continents and years. It's a story of love and family, of India and America, of tradition and modernity. So these two first glimpse each other on an overnight train and they're immediately captivated. Sonia has returned to her family in India, fearing she is haunted by a dark spell. Sunny is attempting to flee his imperious mother and the violence of his warring clan. Uncertain of their future, Sonia and Sunny embark on a search for happiness together as they confront the many alienations of our modern world. So I haven't read this one yet either, but again, it is
goodness. And
on
this
my
was Morin's. This is Morin's hot pick off your pile. She can't wait to read this one. So if Morin says it's worth a read, then we all listen.
Absolutely. And if we've got time for one more.
I think we do.
Got time for one more.
One more.
Well, this is much lighter in tone, but I just wanted to put it in because I enjoyed it so much. So if you, like me, enjoy quirky but real characters, I'm going to highly recommend another debut novel out of the US called Maggie, or A Man and a Woman Walk Into a Bar by Katie Yee. And it's a very funny novel about sad things, which is, I think, one of my favourite.
Funny novel about sad things. This is a whole genre. Maggie, or A Man and a Woman Walk Into a Bar. What a great title.
So the premise is that a man and a woman walk into a restaurant and the woman expects to have a lovely night filled with endless plates of samosas, and instead she finds out that her husband is having an affair with a woman called Maggie. A very short while later, her chest starts to ache, and she walks into an examination room where she finds out the pain in her chest isn't just heartbreak, it's cancer, and she decides to call her tumour Maggie.
Dark. Okay.
It is dark. So we follow the narrator as she embarks on a journey of grief, healing and reclamation. And she starts talking to Maggie, the tumour, and, you know, sort of getting acquainted with her body's new inhabitant. And it's a story told in beautifully formed fragments. If you're a fan of Jenny Offal's impressionistic style, you'll love this, but it's like an easy version of Offal. So she describes these horrendous events in the protagonist's life with such a light touch. Like, there's zero wallowing here.
This is a lovely bookend for your first recommendation
isn't it?
With Nigel Ladder giving us a personal take and then Katie Yee giving us a character
who probably
applies some of the same wisdom that Nigel does.
Yeah.
So what a lovely connection. And that's probably about where we have to call it.
Beautiful.
Oh, wow. another month of fabulous reckons. If you if you can get through that lot before next month, you're doing better than us. We have to spend our time reading the wonderful books of Aotearoa. So this is really exciting for us to have a session where we hear about everybody else that's writing magic books. Thank you very much, Belle.
Thank you,
Scorpio
Lovely
Books.
To be here.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Peter Ryan is an adventurer and hunter and a well-published author and photographer, a veteran of many epic solo journeys within and across South America and Africa, as well as a practiced mountain and bushman and hunter in Aotearoa. His writing may not be known to those many people in the reading world and our listenership, for whom, like me, the world of hunting seems a bit of a world apart. But it's a real shame if you don't know the writing of Peter Ryan. He writes with a passion and beauty that reflects nature. He provides historical research with integrity and fresh insight. And all in all, his newly published book, Riding the Echo Down, which I might not have picked up myself in a store because it's about hunting, is a book that surprised and delighted me. Tēnā koe, Peter. Welcome to Bookends.
Thank you, Marianne. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Peter, this book, it feels like it's intended to take its place among those kinds of classics from maybe from our childhoods of our generation, but I don't know whether their equivalent has existed previously on the shelves. Those books that were intended to inspire a new generation of young minds and hearts to consider adventure to be within their reach. Is that what you hoped? Is that what your intention for the book was?
I'm so pleased to hear you say that. The book actually traces back to the summer of 1978 with me in a treehouse reading Philip Holden's Pack and Rifle, secondhand, and charged with keeping the birds off the fruit trees with an air rifle.
Cool.
So that's the genesis of the concept. Read large, live large.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. So many of these stories have been told someplace before, but not all of them, or not to made accessible to today's young audience. That's certain. I guess not all of the stories are about people who thought they were in any way remarkable, are they?
And, oh, exactly. Sorry, yes, go on.
Yeah, well, so there are many types of personality who do lend themselves to feats of bravery, but your least favourite are the braggarts. I just kind I wonder if you'd tell us, if you'd reflect on that for us.
Well, most of the people in there are what I would call good sorts, and I've tried to find the life that they had that hasn't been published. Jim Muir down in Fiordland would be a good example of a good sort who's been very sort of superficially treated by history as a sort of a servant to a wealthy hunter. But in fact, he was a man who lived a huge and vivid life of his own. And that's what I've tried to uncover here. There's the odd one in there who's a bit of a scallywag, and it probably comes through in the writing that I find them extraordinary. Like, you know, Ewart Grogan walked the length of Africa, but, I guess my lens on how they behaved afterwards comes through. It is possible to be extraordinary and not an altogether likable person as well.
Yeah, indeed. And you start with a little bit of a caution about the kind of revisionism that's has currency today, where we might disregard the stories of people because their values don't sing. But actually what we miss then is some extraordinary tales. Do you want to just talk a little bit about that about your philosophy of that?
Well, I guess we're all creatures of our time. And, you know, some of the things that people may have done 100 years ago, we wouldn't do today. But that doesn't mean that they weren't extraordinary. That said, most of the people in there did a lot of good in the world. I'll go back to, say, Jim Muir, because he's well known. You know, he drove an ambulance on the Western Front for 4 years and walked out of it unscathed. These were people who were trying to do good in the world. But you do get the odd scallywag in there, and maybe you do need a little bit of lemon juice to spice things up once in a while. And those characters are there because they're extraordinary. They did things beyond the dreams of ordinary people, but you have to acknowledge their fallible side, and that's what I do.
Mm. Yes, I think you do that very well. I would just wonder whether you could talk about how you found and the work that you had to do to tell the stories of people who might not be so well known, not well known to a wider audience. People like Snowden, perhaps, and Ethne Smith. Tell me how you found their stories.
Well, I have a huge library of hunting literature and reference books, but also, as I said, it's just on 5 decades in the field. You run into graves, you run into little pieces of history and ephemera, and you look at it, and my nature is as a writer to follow them up and say, where did this come from? Who was this?
Mm-hmm.
And then, because I'm sort of a bit known, people start sending photos, and there are still maybe leftover family members who remember. I covered 75,000 kilometres to put this book together.
Yeah.
And some of it involved visiting remote people, remote places, grave sites, all sorts of things. The lovely thing is that so many people are happy to come forward with old images that have never been seen before to find these people. If you're interested, you'll find it, or it will come to you.
Yeah, remarkable. And I guess it is just that it is a community, isn't it? This world of hunting and naturalists, there's a international community here and an international history that those of us who haven't been exposed might not understand. But if you're in it, there are so many connections.
I'm pleased you mentioned the overlap between hunters and naturalists there. I mean, one of my friends who's a professional hunter in Africa is also a world-class lepidopterist and has been awarded, praise by David Attenborough for his work on butterflies. I mean, most people in the hunting game have an interest in wildlife and wildlife management. So there is a big overlap there. And, yes, it is a global community.
In that context, I had actually intended to say we should probably acknowledge the passing of the fabulous naturalist Jane Goodall. And I wondered whether you'd ever met.
No, I had actually stayed in a camp where she had been just before me.
Right.
So I'm reliably informed that I've slept in the same bed, albeit at a completely different time.
Indeed. Well, so it was sad to hear of her passing today.
It is. It is.
That this book, you've mentioned the Scallywags a couple of times. It's worth noting for listeners that I'm in the same program. You'll hear Peter's wife Vanessa talk about her recently published historical novel, and where both there's a story in here and Vanessa's book are inspired by the life of Grogan, Ewart Grogan, I believe. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, and who was one of those disreputable, really, people and person of not great character who achieved magnificent things. And he was his record of his own adventures was an early inspiration of yours. Is that right, Peter?
It was. I mean, I had his book as a school kid, and later as an aid worker in Africa, I went to visit his grave, and it was all very boy's own adventure kind of stuff. And then in putting together this book, they say never meet your heroes. The more I learned about him, the more conflicted I became, because he was and is an extraordinary figure, but perhaps not a likable figure. And I should point out to many people he's an idol, but they may not necessarily understand his personal life. So maybe you need to separate the person from the achievement sometimes. But that's what Vanessa's book is about. And Ewan Grogan makes a fantastic character, albeit in a reimagined historical novel. You can't take your eyes off him. What's he going to do next?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, and here you get a sense of the life as it was lived, and very much in your book, Riding the Echo Down. So I'm keen to talk with you as well about this overlap between the world of hunting and the world of naturalists. And I guess what I was wondering about is if you could describe how your philosophy of the hunt and why it lends itself to that overlap.
Well, there's, I guess, two sides to this. One is in a country where animals are introduced and have no predators, like New Zealand, wildlife management becomes an issue. Deer and so forth will reproduce. You'll end up with more than you want. Therefore, it doesn't become a question of should there be management. It becomes what kind of management do we have? Do we agree on it? Do we all understand it? And I think we're only in the very beginning of that process here. The Game Animal Council, the minister, lots of science starting to emerge around it, but we've come from a very binary, I hate them, I love them kind of point of view, rather than how do we manage them, which is the next step in the process. There's no point wishing they weren't there. They are there. And there's no point trying to keep all of them either. So it's a question of balance and density. And that's where the Game Animal Council and those sort of bodies are coming into play. But in other countries where the animals are not introduced, for example, there are chapters in Africa, you're really looking at a difficult problem that people imagine the great parks like Kruger or the Mara and think, well, these animals are all endangered. They must all be protected. And so forth. But if you go away from the very popular tourist spots to the other 99% of Africa, poaching is rife, habitat is invaded, charcoal is burned, snaring is rife, the commercial bushmeat market is vast. You're really down to, well, tourists won't come here, it's too expensive, it's full of tsetse fly, it's too dangerous, you can't see anything, the bush is too thick. How do we make these areas viable as protected spaces, as habitat? And the answer is often that rather than 40,000 tourists, you might have a handful of hunters taking 1-2% of the large animals in order to pay for the protection of the entire vast habitat. And there are huge areas of Africa that operate that way because there is no money to do it any other way.
Interested hearing you describe those environments because partly that goes to protecting the, the integrity, the honourability of the hunt as well, that if these, if hunting in these places still requires the kind of tenacity, the kind of understanding of environment, the understanding of the animal in that environment, and the ability to survive hardship in order to pursue, then that there's honour in it as well as the protectorate nature of what it enables. Is that part of the story from your point of view?
That's absolutely true. Without giving away an entire chapter, there is a chapter in the book on this in Mozambique, in the delta of the Zambezi River. There's a million-acre block there. It has 25,000 buffalo on it. There are game department tags for 60 of those each year, which is not even a fraction of natural mortality. But to do that hunt, you go out into the swamps. You will go up to your neck in black water. You will have leeches. You will get bumped by things and you're not sure what they are. There are crocodiles. You will be bitten by lots of tsetse. You will pay for it in order to get that bull, because the difficulty there is that they don't take anything sort of less than 10, 12 years old. In other words, almost a senile old bull is the ambition of what you're there for. So you're hunting very selectively. You're paying for it physically and mentally. It requires a lot of tenacity. There is risk, and you are recovering the meat and taking it back to a village where everything right down to the tripe is consumed. So, look, these balls typically wouldn't last another season, but the amount of money involved is sufficient to pay for anti-poaching, for protecting elephant and all of the other more critically, well, not endangered, but critically protected species. So it is the way for these landscapes to be preserved and for hunters to have actually hunted genuinely and with difficulty, but in a way that leaves the area completely sustainable.
Mm. And I found that provocative, you know, thoughtful narrative and story and perspective in the book that was fresh for me. So thank you very much, and told in such an engaging way with the stories. You mentioned Africa. One of the most engaging stories in here is that I read out loud to an audience of people who had never thought of hunting in their lives, the jaguar hunt. You know, how extraordinary to stand and face a jaguar charging at you and know that that's the right way to hunt it. So do you want to just talk about that a little bit?
Well, that is an historical story. It would never happen today, of course. Mm. But back in the 20s, Sasha Simel hunt jaguar in the Pantanal, a vast wilderness at the time. His job was to hunt stock killing jaguar, not just simply animals living wild. That was the style of the time. It still is today, only illegally. I should point out that nearly all of the things that people used to do that were socially accepted then still occur today, but are simply illegal. It's not as though they've gone away, those behaviours. Poaching is still rife in the Pantanal.
Mm.
But in terms of physical courage, and that's why I talk about, the title Riding the Echo Down comes from a poem which is essentially about giving oneself up to adventure and fear of risk and losing that fear of risk to dare to have an adventure. And these people, like Sasha Simel, are all there because they had that mindset of to hell with it, just go, the consequences be damned.
Mm.
That's the spirit of this book. He can capture that with simply hunting these huge cats. I mean, jaguar are far bigger than leopards.
Mm.
With a spear, and it's very likely he would have died out there if he kept doing it. But it was something that came from deep within him and eventually went away. Mm.
Yes, not all of your adventurers live long lives, but it's surprising how many do.
Guys like De Weert, Carton De Weert, the World War I soldier. I mean, he probably should have died 50 times over. Most of these people should have died 50 times over. But that's why they're there as extraordinary. And I feel that the modern world of social media and remote controls and going to the mall, maybe these people's lives have something to offer us in terms of taking on real things, growing through struggle, accepting risk. These things are all anathema today. They're things that most of society wants to avoid. And looking at the old photos, I just wondered, do we need to bring a little bit of this back? And I don't mean necessarily the kind of hunting they did back then, but simply that mindset of risk happens. I may die here. I need to see what's over the next hill. I need to know what's out there. Because
indeed,
true wilderness and adventure is still out there. It's not lost.
Exactly. I think that's right. I think, and it comes through in the book, the potential, even in our Aotearoa environment, so much potential for risk, adventure, and through that, character development. And I just want to acknowledge, you talk about the war experience. So many of these men and women of the past, their experience through the Great War and the Second World War, is a massive part of their story, and then their following sense of adventure, you know, as well, off the top of that. They're lives that are hard to emulate today, but there is still opportunity.
100%. But the other thing that I've noticed about their lives, because they people send me the images and so forth, and you start to see them pop off the page, is that not only did they have that riding the echo down, that element of adventure to them, they also had a lot of respect. I mean, they tried to help people. They tried to do good things in the world. They were, again, the opposite of what you see in online behaviors, where people troll people openly. They behave in ways they would never behave in person. And I thought, well, maybe there's not just the adventure side of these people that needs to be brought back into our world, but maybe a little bit of how they treated each other and their level of respect for themselves and for others. Again, it comes, I think, from struggle. If you've been through something, you're more likely to respect.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, Peter. Thank you for your book. I think you're so right. The book has as much about character development as it does about adventure and the fact they go hand in hand. So that's all we have time for. I'm sad to finish the conversation, but the book is Riding the Echo Down. It's by Peter Ryan and it's published by Bateman Books.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Vanessa Croft is the Canterbury-based author of recently published historical novel Where in All the World. In her childhood, as the daughter of a civil engineer, Vanessa's family lived variously in Australia, Nigeria, and Papua New Guinea, and she has travelled extensively since. That love of places on the edges of Western imperialism and her fascination with history are both deeply evident in this first novel. Tēnā koe, Vanessa, thanks very much for joining us on the show.
Kia ora, thank you very much for having me.
So how does it feel to have your first book out there in the world?
Thrilling, terrifying in equal measure. I mean, it's a long-term ambition that I've had, a dream since I was a little girl, and I'm just absolutely delighted that someone's happy to take a chance and hopefully lots of readers will enjoy it.
Great. Well, the story, listeners, for readers of historical fiction, the story is based on some real-life characters and events. And so I think that's a great place to start. Perhaps you could tell us about your muse, Gertrude Edith Watt, and why you wanted to give her character a fresh fictional opportunity that she never really had herself.
Yeah, I think one of the beauties of divergent history writing is that it gives you the chance to say, what if? And there's so much known about Ewart Grogan and so little known about Gertrude Watt. When I was understanding the adventures that Ewart was experiencing, the question I had the whole time was, how did Gertrude feel about this? What was her experience of it? It was an enormously grandiose romantic gesture that Ewart is allegedly supposed to have undertaken. And yet there's no mention of her in his books. There's very little reference to her in history. The question was inevitably, well, why? What happened to her? Why do we not know more about her? I mean, she ought to have been a celebrated person in New Zealand history, and yet there's nothing that I can find out. So it gave me the chance to sort of imagine what it might have been for her, like for her as a person who gets a little bit left behind and forgotten in this history. I wanted to sort of celebrate that a little bit and bring it to the foreground that she's a remarkable woman and did remarkable things and survived in remarkable journeys, and it was time we understood who she was and what happened. The ending is different in my book from what really happened to Gertrude, though.
Mm, indeed. And far more hopeful,
and, yeah, exactly.
which is beautiful for the reader. That era of imperial exploring, it was grossly exploitative, wasn't it? And yet there is still something romantic, swashbuckling. There's something kind of, we give it a nobility in our sentiment and the way that we portray it usually. How important was it for you to avoid that in your book?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, it's very difficult when you're researching and writing about that period in time to know how best to convey it. I think I had the advantage of writing a book from the first-person POV, so I could translate what was going on in and around the world of Harriet from her point of view. She was experiencing as a person there at the time, and we had to be very conscious that how we reflect back now and remember what happened during that time was not necessarily how it was being conveyed for the people who were experiencing it then. So seeing history through the lens of modern day time is something you have to be very careful about when you're doing literary histories based in the past. So being very sensitive to it, but also being realistic to how they would have experienced it is a tricky path to pay. And all you can really do is research and try to be respectful.
Yeah. You give Harriet a very gentle soul and also a personal kind of moral compass, and she's surrounded by people who have those moral compass as well in that context. And I think that allows you to navigate some of that critical perspective on the activity of history, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, she enters into the realm of some of the much more conventional or historical stereotypical people of the colonial period, the British ones, particularly those who were busy in East Africa. Coming from the New Zealand experience, however, was quite different. I don't think that the way that the colonials who arrived in New Zealand had the same intentions that they did in East Africa at the time. So I think that framed a little bit about her experience. She also came from an attitude of being someone who grew up quite close to her family, her native environment, with the people around her, her love of the wild places and those kinds of things. She was just quite a natural and genuine, authentic person at heart. And I think she took that with her. And I think that also made her a little bit prone to being exploited, I think.
Yeah, sure. Able to be exploited, but also able to view the activity around her with a slightly different perspective ultimately. Yeah. When she encounters Sir Goodwin, I think, and she reassures him that in her opinion, is that Leopold's regime must be exposed, arrested, and his conduct rebuked at the highest level. She's at her most likable. She comes into her strength in that way. But we probably don't. How common did you know that there was dissent among privileged society at that time? Was that a factual in your research that you came across?
Yes.
That? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. It was a surprising thing about colonial history. I think we were at the end of the sort of 19th century there, and England in particular was learning a lot about the consequences and I think the costs of colonialisation. There was a lot of dissent in Parliament at the time about entering Uganda, for instance, and you know, the book follows a little bit about the construction of the Uganda line, what we know as the Lunatic Line, and whether there was a lot of sense in actually pursuing it and going to the extremes that it was taking in order to engineer that particular endeavour. There was also the question about they were sending off the explorers to the Antarctic around that period as well, and the cost of doing that. So there was constant debate, and they were saying that it's often, you know, what we're forgetting is that there are whole swathes of England and Scotland, Northern England and Scotland and Ireland, who were massively underprivileged and suffering and enduring the worst ends of the Industrial Revolution, so that some people could be celebrated and go overseas and explore countries to what end?
To what end, yeah.
Yeah. So I was very conscious that, yes, all that argument was going on.
Mm.
And didn't really want to convey that, because sometimes I think a very black and white view of how the colonial history was rolling out at that time, we can forget that there were still people and there were still people who were very much involved in the context of what was happening, who were debating it very hard, whether it was good, right, proper, beneficial, what were the impacts, what were the long-term consequences of these things.
Mm.
Yeah, they were aware of it at the time.
Fascinating. You intimated this originally, but there is another story here as well, and it's a general one, not just an historical one. It's that you write that it's informed by the reality of relationships with narcissistic men, and so that's a across time kind of reality, but. Is there a personal story behind that, or simply an empathetic author's exploration of your character, given what we knew about the real Greta?
Well, I think it was the inspiration came from trying to wrap my head around Gertrude's relationship with Ewart Grogan.
Mm.
There was no definition, there was no recognition of a condition called narcissism back in the 19th century when this was obviously set. But when you understand what Ewart Grogan was doing and what he was like and how he treated his wife, you start to see all those very recognisable signs and traits and mannerisms and characteristics of a person who's obviously got a grandiose narcissism. And I'm certainly not a doctor or a psychiatrist or anything, or would never want to say that for sure he was diagnosed with that, but I think... it was fascinating for me to sort of untangle what those features were and how she then had to respond to that and survive it, really.
Mm.
Certainly not a personal story or experience of mine. In fact, my husband has said many times, make sure everybody knows he is not me.
I was really giving you an opportunity to say that. But I think, but I also do think that it is... an interesting take on the real people from history. And it also does give you a beautiful tension to work with in this story, in the novel, doesn't it? How Harriet comes to her strength, surviving that relationship. So congratulations on that. It's a massive project. For the fellow writers in our audience, can you tell us just quickly about the work of researching a book like this? How long has this book been in the writing?
I think it took about a year to write from beginning to end in terms of the first draft, let alone all the editing and all the rest of it. But I did actually compile a bibliography before I submitted the text, the manuscript, through to Bateman Books, because I wasn't sure if it was something that they would want, but I thought I'd better have it up my sleeve in case they do. And I remember reading something that was like 100 and something odd various sources of research that I went through to pull the book together. I mean, there's large-scale biographies on Ewart Grogan to begin with, Coleman, who is Gertrude Watt's stepfather, Lust for Land, his is a book about his and the Watt family in New Zealand, all the way through to narcissistic personality disorder texts on that. I had to find out, are narcissists commonly violent in domestic violent relationships? And, yes, apparently they are. All the way through to there's a story in Canberra about a woman who transforms from, a woman into an elephant. It was an origin story of the first elephants in East Africa at the time. And, yes, even that. So, yeah, the breadth and width of subject matter in the book that needed to be researched before I would commit it to paper is very expensive indeed. I wouldn't say that I'm any expert on any single one of those things, but holistically as a book, I was trying to thread a story through the entire lot. A lot.
Fantastic. What a wonderful undertaking. And how great to have it out there in the world. We're celebrating that with you, listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. The book is Where in All the World by Vanessa Croft. It's published by Bateman Books and it's available in bookstores nationwide.
And join us, Mary-Ann Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.